This evening's program is going to be significant, I think, not only for the information that it contains about events themselves, but also because tonight's program, God willing and the crick don't rise, assuming it works out properly, will shed some light on some methodological considerations with regard to the operations of fascism and also the history of fascism, the two obviously being intimately connected. One of the things that we're going to be doing this evening is examining why many of the things that I refer to on this program are not particularly well known. Not only are the events themselves often conducted clandestinely, but beyond that, because many of the things that have taken place under fascist governments, many of the things that fascists do are so distasteful that many of the extremely prestigious elements that have and do back fascism prefer that fact, the fact that they back fascism and have done so historically, not be known to those who are often the victims of some of the occurrences and tactics that fascists have engaged in over the years and perpetrated over the years. For want of a better term, and I think this would probably be a very, very good term, the title of tonight's show is going to be Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. Il Duce, of course, referring to Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. That theme, so to speak, is in turn taken from an op-ed column that appeared in the San Francisco Examiner this past Wednesday, August 31st. Of 1994. By the way, for the benefit of those who are listening to this program on tape, today is Sunday, November 4th of 1994, Labor Day weekend of 1994. In the 831-94 San Francisco Examiner, there is an op-ed column by Walter Brasch, B-R-A-S-C-H, described here as a Ph.D., former newspaper reporter and editor, author of 9 books, and professor of journalism at Bloomsburg University. That's in Pennsylvania. The title of this column is The Professor, Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. And this column reads in part, It was an upper division university class. The professor made a fleeting reference to Benito Mussolini. When he saw more blank faces than usual, he asked how many could identify the name. That's when he learned that only 12 of his class of 27 students knew anything about Italy's fascist dictator in World War II. A lot of the students, all of whom graduated in at least the top half of their high school classes, couldn't name the states surrounding Pennsylvania, had no clue where Somalia was in relation to the rest of Africa, and couldn't name their representatives in Congress. This particular column, I think, is significant in a couple of ways. For one thing, it is significant because it goes into the importance of education and of literacy in terms of not only understanding history, but by understanding history, maintaining or assuring or ensuring, perhaps, the political integrity of a democratic society. This column goes on to discuss the sadly weakening academic standards in this country, in particular the unwillingness of professors to hand out tough grades, and attributes much of the decline of political, historical, political and historical awareness, and beyond that, and even more importantly perhaps, mere competence, to lowering academic standards and the unwillingness of professors to bite the bullet academically, so to speak. I think the weakening of the educational system, the limiting of good education, so to speak, to those who are born into or have achieved relatively affluent economic status, in the end, exclusively, but also in the beginning, I guess one could say, works to the benefit of totalitarianism, and it works to the detriment of democracy, because it is only by understanding history and only by understanding specifically the history of fascism that someone can reasonably recognize fascism when they see it. The truth concerning fascism is considerably different from what most people in this culture are accustomed to thinking about. One of the things that I have spent a lot of time on over the years concerns the profound connections between very, very powerful and very prestigious elements in Western society and the fascist powers of Europe, both before, during, and after World War II, because indeed fascism survived World War II. We're going to be discussing the underground survival of fascism this evening, among other things. And in fact, fascism was not a fluke. It was not an historical accident. The popular viewpoint of fascism as disseminated in our educational system and in our mass media is of a political aberration. Fascism is portrayed as an historical aberration, as something of an accident, basically, according to pop history that disseminated by our media, our mass media, and unfortunately perpetuated to a large extent in our educational system, is of a fluke event in which a couple of charismatic screwballs named Hitler and Mussolini hypnotized everybody, made them all go crazy, and then there was a nasty war, and then the Allies made everybody live happily ever after, or would have if it had not been for Stalin. In fact, that is not the case. Fascism was a very self-conscious reaction against not only the increasingly organized, effective, and militant labor movements that grew up largely in reaction to the conditions of the Great Depression, but beyond that, the phenomenon of world fascism, of the advent of fascism after World War I, was also a direct reaction to the formation of the world's first socialist state, that, of course, being the Soviet Union, with Marxism no longer being just an abstract ideology adhered to by labor unions and social thinkers in various parts of the world, with a state that had now organized its means of production and even its culture along the lines preached by Marx and Lenin. Many of the most powerful industrialists, financiers, and corporations not only backed an extreme, militant, right-wing political philosophy, which subjugated democracy to the desired goal of anti-communism and of anti-labor enforcement, but which also collaborated very consciously with like-minded individuals and like-minded elements in other parts of the world. Industrialists and financiers in the United States and Britain, for example, as well as French industrialists and financiers and political figures and military figures, collaborated actively with corporations, with political figures, with national security figures in the fascist powers of Europe, also Japan as well, but to a greater extent in Europe. Many of our most powerful industrialists and financiers, many political figures, and also many national security figures in the United States looked to Hitler and Mussolini, or looked upon Hitler and Mussolini with great favor because of their, that is to say, Hitler's and Mussolini's doctrinaire anti-communism, and also because of their anti-labor stance. Fascism was not actually an aberration. Not only did the anti-communist and anti-labor ideology of fascism endear it to many of the most powerful industrialists and financiers around the world, who then supported fascism wholeheartedly. They supported Hitler, they supported Mussolini, and they also supported fascist movements in their own countries. Some of the archive shows, by the way, referring to that, Radio Free America shows 1 and 2, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, U.S. Industrial Cooperation with Nazi Germany, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, also Radio Free America program number 10, and Radio Free America program number 37. I would also note that, as we have seen in the archive shows about euthanasia in Nazi Germany and contemporary America, as well as a related program or archive series called The Seeds of Nuremberg, at an intellectual level as well, fascism, and in particular the extermination programs that were put into place by the Third Reich and which culminated in Hitler's extermination of European Jewry, those racial laws which culminated in the Third Reich's extermination programs were based on a school of intellectual thought in which the practice of euthanasia and other disciplines, if one could call those disciplines, in order to effect eugenics, a genetic improvement of the human race, the Nazi laws were based, or were derived, I should say, from a very highly and very effectively established and very prestigious intellectual movement, the International Mental Hygiene Movement, which in turn gave rise to the International Eugenics Movement and the International Euthanasia Movement. Indeed, much of the Nazi euthanasia and eugenics legislation was predicated upon eugenics legislation that was based in the United States. The aforementioned book, archive series, I should say, The Seeds of Nuremberg, in turn drawing on the book The Nazi Connection by Stefan Kuh, go into the very direct connection between American scientific racism of the 1930s and 1940s and the scientific racism and legal precepts which derive from it in Nazi Germany. In turn, the school of scientific racism which created the eugenics legislation in the United States, upon which the Nazi legislation was based to a considerable extent, is a school of intellectual thought that has survived to this day and that the Reagan and Bush administrations, among others, looked upon with great favor. It is worth understanding, first of all, that a vital educational system, an aware body politic, an intellectually active and intellectually well-informed body politic, are things that are essential to not only preserve democracy, but those are things which are detrimental to fascism. The dumbing out or dumbing down of society, so to speak, the lowering of educational and intellectual standards, the blunting of historical and political awareness as a result, in turn makes the possibility of fascism or the possibility of the advent of fascism that much more likely. Because people will not, in fact, Johnny, going back to this column from the Examiner of 831-94, Johnny won't be able to identify Il Duce when Il Duce is in front of him. First of all, if he doesn't know who Il Duce was or where he came from, he's not going to recognize Il Duce. Beyond that, if Johnny does not understand, and most Johnnies and most Janies too, do not understand that Mussolini was not a fluke, that in fact his corporate state, so to speak, was propped up by American capital to a large extent. The American media covered for Mussolini. American financiers loaned capital to his municipalities and to his government and to his industry in order to prop it up. American media covered for Mussolini's corporate state and its many failures. And in fact, Mussolini was even named an honorary member of the American Legion in 1935, an honor that was later rescinded on a technicality. If Johnny can't read, and if Janie can't read, then they're not likely to find out that, in fact, Mussolini was not a fluke, and that, in fact, the forces that lay behind Mussolini and Hitler are forces that are very much present in this society, so that if Johnny or Janie are idiots, if they're poorly educated, if they can't read, then they're not going to be able to identify Il Duce, because, in fact, Il Duce derived from things that are very much with us here in the U.S. of A. They were with us in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, and they are very much with us today. And it is worth understanding what those things are and how they work. And beyond that, it's worth understanding why it is that fascism is a phenomenon which is very poorly understood, despite the fact that it is very important, it is ongoing, and it is on the march and gaining around the world. We're going to take a look not only at some aspects of fascism that are not generally well known. We're going to take a look, for example, at how the very same Western, quote, democracies, unquote, which had supported Hitler and Mussolini so avidly in the pre-World War II and to a certain extent in the World War II periods, then took in many of the most heinous fascist elements and either used them in their own intelligence systems and defense industries, and or put them right back into power in the countries that they had held forth in before the end of World War II. I have spoken at great length over the years about the incorporation into the American intelligence system, for example, of the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit. That was the Third Reich's Eastern Front intelligence outfit under German Major General Reinhard Gehlen. At the end of the war, Gehlen and his organization jumped to the fledgling Central Intelligence Agency. After a brief stint working for military intelligence, they became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. They were the exclusive purveyors of intelligence on that part of the world to the CIA. They became the de facto NATO intelligence organization. And eventually they became the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the German intelligence service, began as the West German, now the German intelligence service. And through bureaucratic inertia and through the subterranean or clandestine perpetuation of Nazism and fascism in Germany, the BND retains much of its original Third Reich character to this day. We're going to take a look this evening at some of the methodology of fascism in an operational sense, because one of the many reasons why Johnny or Janie can't identify Il Duce is that Il Duce, just like the Führer, has taken great pains to operate in a tactical sense in such a way as to be largely out of sight. Indeed, fascism at a practical organizational, at the practical organizational level, has long operated in a clandestine and cellular fashion, specifically in order to go undetected and to grow in strength and effectiveness as a result of the fact that many of their victims-to-be are not aware of their presence. This evening, we're going to be taking a look at the hows of fascism in terms of how fascism operates in a clandestine and largely cellular sense. We're also going to be taking a look this evening at an illustration of one of my favorite quotes. I use it on an almost weekly basis. It comes from author William Faulkner, who said, "The past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past." And this evening, in addition to taking a look at the methodology of fascism as well as the history of fascism, we're going to be taking a look at the historical and operational continuity between the fascism of Hitler and Mussolini in the 1930s and 1940s and the fascism that is already in power to a large extent in Italy, the fascism which is wielding power to a large extent behind the scenes in Germany and threatening to achieve power in, openly in Germany. The fascism of today in places like Germany, in places like Italy, in places like Austria, is indeed a direct continuation of the fascism of the 1930s and 40s, and we're going to be looking at some of the elements this evening that are elements connecting the fascism of the World War II period with the fascism of today. Because indeed, the fascism of the World War II period and the fascism of today are very, very closely connected. So in addition to looking at the methodological aspects of fascism, in addition to looking at its tactics, and in particular its cellular organizational foundation and its clandestine methodology, we're going to be taking a look at how that methodology has helped to perpetuate fascism in an underground fashion to a large extent, and how in turn that fascism, the fascism of Hitler and Mussolini, the fascism of the 1930s and 40s, the fascism of World War II, has in fact remained in place. It has remained in power, albeit to a large extent clandestinely, and indeed the fascism that is manifesting itself now in some of the so-called neo-Nazi attacks in Germany, the fascism that's manifesting itself in Italy with some of the startling things that are coming out of the right-wing fascist alliance of Silvio Berlusconi, the fascism which is on the march in places like Austria is indeed the fascism of Hitler, Mussolini, and World War II. It is a fascism which has been perpetuated largely out of the political gaze or out of the political sight of an awful lot of people who should be taking much more interest in this sort of thing than, in fact, they do. This evening's program is also, to a considerable extent, going to address or will touch on the those aspects of fascist methodology which, when viewed by those who are unfamiliar with and also critical of this type of work, lead critics of this type of research to demean it as, quote, conspiracy theory, unquote. Fascism by its nature, and in particular the fascism of Adolf Hitler, German National Socialism, has, as a matter of course, sought to operate outside of the views of the legal authority. Nazism and fascism have operated clandestinely, and indeed the genesis of German National Socialism and the operational basis of German National Socialism has, to a large extent, been espionage, spying, the world of covert operations or clandestine services. Indeed, at an operation or in an operational sense, both in the pre-World War II and World War II periods and today, fascism has operated in the sort of clandestine fashion that an intelligence agency would operate in. And indeed, as we have seen in Radio Free America program number 10, as well as a miscellaneous archive series dealing with the origins of the Nazi Party, Adolf Hitler himself got his start in political life as an undercover operative for the political department of the German army, the Reichswehr, under General von Lossow. Indeed, the German National Socialist Workers' Party, or the Nazi Party, was a resurrection of a moribund political party, the German Socialist Workers' Party, which was infiltrated by pan-German propagandists and other agents, or by and Adolf Hitler and other agents of the Reichswehr political department. And in its inception, the German Nazi Party was literally an intelligence front. It was a vehicle for introducing not only elements of the supposedly demobilized German army into civilian society for the purposes of effecting political reaction through covert or clandestine military operations, or paramilitary operations would be a better way of putting it, but beyond that, the Nazi Party, the German National Socialist Workers' Party, in its inception as an intelligence front, was a vehicle for the dissemination of the type of nationalist and reactionary political ideology that the German army's political department sought to have propagated in Germany. So in examining fascism and examining the history and the operations of fascism, it's important to understand that much of it takes place outside, deliberately outside of the public viewpoint, so to speak, and beyond that, that clandestine operations are inextricably linked with fascism and Nazism, not only because of the key operational tenet of staying out of the public view for the purposes of gaining strength, not mobilizing opposition until it is time to emerge into view, but also Nazism itself grew directly out of the espionage apparatus of post-World War I Germany. It grew as a direct product of the national security establishment of Weimar Germany, which in turn was a continuum of that of the Kaiser. People demean this type of research as conspiracy theory because they're dealing with a field of intellectual inquiry which is, for the most part, dealing with things that are going on behind the scenes. This obviously entails a preoccupation with the clandestine. It also entails or necessitates, to a certain extent at least, some intelligent extrapolation. I think the demeaning of this type of work as conspiracy theory is unfortunate, but at the same time, it really does come with the address, so to speak. And one of the things we're going to be looking at this evening is why anti-fascist research, and that is how I refer to myself as an anti-fascist, and that is how I refer to this type of work, anti-fascist research, rather than conspiracy theory. It anti-fascist research, that is necessarily going to be demeaned as conspiracy theory because it is necessarily going to be, or it is going to be demeaned by those who are unfamiliar with it or hostile to it as conspiracy theory because anti-fascist research, by its very nature, is going to be dealing with the clandestine and, to a large extent, attempting to ferret out the clandestine. So what we're going to be looking at this evening is basically why Johnny or why Janie can't identify Il Duce, why Il Duce and Der Fuhrer have sought to deliberately hide their operations. We are going to take a look at why many of the prestigious and powerful elements that backed Hitler and Mussolini and that back fascism today do not want the true history of fascism known. And we're going to take a look at the clandestine nature of fascism and Nazism in particular and how that has permitted operational continuity between the World War II period and today. I would note that at least in the United States, as the educational system and consequently the intellectual level and the political and historical awareness are sinking, and that basically why Johnny or Janie can't identify Il Duce, there is in power in Italy at this very time a government which is a direct outgrowth to a considerable extent of the Italian fascism of Benito Mussolini. We looked in the June 26th broadcast, one of the installments of the Seeds of Nuremberg series that I alluded to, at the genesis of the Silvio Berlusconi right-wing slash fascist coalition that grew directly out of the P2 Lodge, a Masonic lodge which became, in effect, a crypto-fascist government which ran Italy. The P2 Lodge was headed up by a former Mussolini supporter and Waffen-SS officer named Licio Gelli, and it involved many prominent Italian business people, intelligence officers, military officers, people involved with the media, people involved with organized crime, key politicians. And the P2 Lodge became a center of occult conspiracy in Italy, literally a crypto-fascist government, which in effect ran Italy for a considerable period of time, and Silvio Berlusconi, a member of the P2 Lodge, and his ascension to power represents a successful realization of Licio Gelli's democratic rebirth strategy, that for a democratic rebirth of fascism. And as a result of the activities of the P2 Lodge, and as a result of the activities of those who have supported the P2 Lodge over the years, at this time there is in Italy the first European government since World War II which has open and official participation by members of a fascist political party. This is by no means the first government in post-World War II Europe with fascists in positions of power, but this is the first time that there has been a government in which fascists have held ministerial posts, members of an openly fascist political party. We're seeing a lot of interesting things starting to come out of Italy under the circumstances, including attempts at rehabilitating Il Duce and fascism in general. I'd like to touch very briefly on an article that I dealt with a couple of weeks back. This is from the San Francisco Examiner of Wednesday, August 17th of 1994. And Johnny may not be able to identify Il Duce, but when and if he does, he may eventually be identifying Il Duce as somebody who is positive. Because indeed, the resurrection and the cleaning up of not only Mussolini, but perhaps fascism in general, or the cleaning up of the image, is underway in a big, big way. Examiner 8, 1794 has the following story from the London Times by John Phillips, Dateline Rome, headlined, Italy heralds fascist, subheaded Philosopher Gentile to be remembered with new stamp. That's Gentile. The article reads in part, Italy's right-wing government has begun the rehabilitation of the fascist philosopher Giovanni Gentile by deciding to issue a commemorative stamp marking the 50th anniversary of his death. The Minister for Posts and Telecommunications, Giuseppe Tattarella, T-A-T-A-R-E-L-L-A, ordered that the stamp be issued in October following what he said was an almost unanimous quote-unquote decision by Italy's National Philatelic Council. Gentile joined the fascist party in 1923 and was a leading figure in developing its ideology and educational program. In 1925, Gentile organized the publication of The Manifesto of Fascist Intellectuals, unquote, which hailed Benito Mussolini's movement as the moral regeneration of Italians. Left-wing partisans assassinated the philosopher in Florence in April of 1944. The rehabilitation of the fascist scholar has begun 50 years after his death, unquote, the newspaper La Stampa commented Tuesday. Mr. Tattarella is a member of the primarily neo-fascist National Alliance Party, which joined the coalition government led by Italian media magnate Silvio Berlusconi. So if Johnny or Janie can't identify Il Duce, if the people currently running Italy have their way, eventually they'll be identifying Il Duce and other fascists in a positive light. We should note at this juncture that Italian fascism in the person or in the form of the P2 Lodge was perpetuated largely as a result of the connivance of the conquering authorities. The Allies, chiefly the United States, actively collaborated with Italian fascists and put them in power after the occupation of Italy by the Allied armies. We have looked at great length in the past at the P2 Lodge in Radio Free America shows 18 through 21, and we've looked at its collaboration with Western governments and with Western national security establishments in particular in programs 19, 20, and 21, later in 32, 34, 35, and the miscellaneous archive show about Operation Gladio. The P2 Lodge itself is significant from a methodological standpoint because the use of small but very relatively powerful clandestine bodies is a characteristic of the operations of fascism as realized and conceptualized by Adolf Hitler, and indeed in terms of its operational methodologies, fascism and espionage, or clandestine warfare, covert operations, are inextricably linked. And we should note the evolution of the politics of the propaganda due, a small, in terms of number, but very powerful clandestine body, a clandestine group. And we should note its successful evolution, or what to date has been successful evolution, into an overt political coalition in Italy, which, as I said, now represents, not doesn't represent, it is the first elected post-World War II government with active participation by members of a fascist political party. That political party, the National Alliance, in turn has grown directly out of the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the Italian fascist party that grew out directly out of the fascist party of Benito Mussolini. By the way, before we take a look at another fascist who was being rehabilitated, let's take a look ever so briefly, to a certain extent at least, this will be by way of review, at the fascist participation in the current Italian cabinet. Now, for a fair amount of the information on tonight's broadcast, we're going to be relying on a British anti-fascist publication called The Searchlight. This should not be confused with the American Spotlight, a far right-wing publication which could be viewed in many ways as the Searchlight's opposite number. The Searchlight is a British anti-fascist publication. The Spotlight is American and of a radically different political nature. So don't confuse the two. The Searchlight, the British publication, can be subscribed to. Information about that coming up right now.
To subscribe to The Searchlight, a British anti-fascist publication, write to Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, or phone 011-4471-284-4040 or fax 011-4471-284-4410. That's The Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, phone 011-4471-284-4040, or fax at 011-4471-284-4410.
That again for the Searchlight. We're going to take a look at an article about the five fascist ministers in the current Italian government. We looked at a projection from the May 1994 issue of the Searchlight about who those appointments would probably be. We're going to look at a following article from the June 1994 issue of the Searchlight. This is number 228. Again, the June 1994 Searchlight, the International Anti-Fascist Monthly. Research credit on the following article goes to a listener. In Searchlight on the World, in the Searchlight on the World section, that we find the following article, and again it is headlined, Italy gets five fascist ministers. Skipping down into the article, we find, well, by the way, before going into this, one of the ministers you're going to hear about is the aforementioned Mr. Tarantella. Note also the presence of various ministers who were associated with the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, because that was the that is the Italian fascist political party that was the direct successor to Mussolini's Fascisti, and as we shall see, the eventual rise to power of these individuals represents a successful perpetuation of the Italian fascism of the World War II period, and in the form of the P2 Lodge, a small, clandestine, occult body of power, we can see the methodological, operational paradigm of fascism, the use of relatively small but effective clandestine bodies as vehicles for political action, eventually paving the way for the emergence of those previously clandestine forces into overt political ascendance. The P2 Lodge and its eventual blossoming into the current Silvio Berlusconi government could be seen as something of a paradigm for the operations of fascism, and we're going to be taking a look at that use of small clandestine bodies as vehicles for effecting covert operation, or the sort of covert operation that is necessary for the rise of fascism. It's something we're going to be looking at throughout the course of the evening. By the way, I would also point out that Nazism in particular developed an operational methodology which is basically the same, which proved to be basically the same for the acquisition of power in Germany proper or for the conquest of some of Germany's neighbors. We're going to get into that a little bit later. But note here, the Italian ministers who have derived or have come out of the MSI, because the MSI is one of the elements of fascist political continuity and historical continuity that we're going to be looking at this evening. From the Searchlight of June of 1994, the five Movimento Sociale Italiano Alleanza Nazionale, MSIAN fascists, are the first to hold ministerial positions in a Western government since the destruction of European fascism in 1945. Holding the key defense portfolio, giving control of the armed forces, is Cesare Previti, Previti, 60, millionaire vice president of Berlusconi's Fininvest communications monopoly. Previti, now this is the fellow who's in charge of the Ministry of Defense, Previti is a former member of the MSI who is a fascist in all but party membership. One of his first proposals has been to wind up all the activities of the anti-corruption, quote, clean hands, unquote, commission. This is hardly a surprise in light of the fact that a Milan court ruled on May 2nd that three top executives of Berlusconi's media and industrial Fininvest empire should be put in preventive detention pending inquiries into alleged falsification of their firm's accounts. Also under the microscope of both the Clean Hands Commission and the Anti-Mafia Commission is Berlusconi's brother Paolo, who has been charged with bribery. Previti is Berlusconi's lawyer. That's Paolo Berlusconi, Silvio Berlusconi's brother. So note, Previti in charge of the Ministry of Defense, former member of MSI. Continuing, controlling the strategically important posts and telecommunications ministry is Giuseppe Tattarella, a member of the MSI who makes no secret of his fascism. He will also be deputy prime minister. Now, of course, Tatarell is the fellow who is responsible for the issuing of the stamp that is sort of rehabilitating the reputation of the Italian fascist philosopher Giovanni Gentili. We read about that in the 817 Examiner article just a few minutes ago. Continuing. The transport minister is Publio Fiori, a 56-year-old lawyer who, though not a member of the MSI, is a virulent anti-communist. He defected to the MSIAN from the Christian Democrats. Adriana Poli Bortoni will direct affairs at the Agriculture Ministry, vital in the relationship of with the European Union. Excuse me. The only woman in the cabinet, 50-year-old Bortoni, B-O-R-T-O-N-E, is a hardliner on the right of the MSI and has been an MP since 1983. The new Environment Minister, Alessandro Mattioli, M-A-T-T-E-O-L-I, is a longtime MSI member. He was elected to Parliament in 1983 and was Regional Secretary of the MSI in Tuscany. The final MSI-AN Minister is Domenico Fisichella, F-I-S-I-C-H-E-L-L-A, the Heritage Minister. Fisichella, let me read that last sentence again. The final MSIAN minister is Domenico Fisichella, the Heritage Minister. Fisichella is a monarchist and a Julius Evola fan who helped MSI leader Gianfranco Fini establish the Alleanza Nazionale. Julius Evola, by the way, is a Nazi mystical theoretician. I would also note that the Defense Undersecretary, this is an article we've read before on this program, has a very interesting background as well. In a sidebar to the article I just read you from the June 1994 Searchlight, we find the following under the headline of Arrested with Guns. Guido Laporta, the new defense undersecretary, has an interesting past. On October 24, 1969, Laporta, 56, who has been an MSI deputy since 1972, was arrested on the outskirts of Palermo with three others, Alfio Lopresti, Ferdinando Mistretta, and Pierluigi Concutelli, C-O-N-C-U-T-E-L-L-I. The car in which they were traveling was found to contain four machine guns, other guns, seven hand grenades, and 500 rounds of ammunition. The carabinieri were told not to make any written notes or notify the newspapers. Concutelli is now serving life imprisonment for the murder of Judge Vittorio Accorsio and the attempted murder of Judge Pierluigi Vigna of Florence. Accorsio was looking into, among other things, the operations of Michele Sindona, former Vatican financial advisor, a key member of the P2. Pierluigi Concutelli, one of the key members of the Internazionale Fascista, a coalition of international fascist elements involving Italian fascists, Spanish fascists, many of the residual Third Reich elements, and operating very closely with elements of the P2 Lodge, and also participating, as indicated in this particular incident, or the incident that is described here, participating in the strategy of tension. Much of the Italian terror that took place in the 1960s, 1970s, and also 80s was aided and abetted not only by NATO, but specifically by elements of the U.S. national security establishment. The strategy of tension, for example, was a program of terror, bombings, kidnappings, and assassinations that was financed in part by the CIA. It was perpetuated by elements within Italian intelligence and within the national security establishment. It was very closely identified with elements of the P2 Lodge, and it involved the staging of terrorist incidents to be blamed on the left in order to discredit the left and also to drive the Italian political electorate to the right. The conduit for funds going to the strategy of tension and also the 1970 Borghese coup attempt, a fascist coup attempt in Italy, came from the CIA, and the fellow who was the fellow who was the conduit for the funding of the strategy of tension was Michele Sindona.